1 year since the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Taliban government in Kabul continues to struggle with a rapidly deteriorating humanitarian situation in the country amid crippling U.S. sanctions and a shortage of funds. Millions of Afghans are without work now. The banking system is virtually dysfunctional. Medical facilities are lying in tatters. And the worst humanitarian catastrophe in modern history is in the making. Almost entire Afghan population is living below the poverty line today, according to the UN Development Program. Many Afghans have expressed anger over the Biden administration's decision to withhold billions of dollars in frozen assets from the Afghan Central Bank, distributing large parts to the families of the 9/11 victims. Worse, the U.S. sanctions have devastated the banking system and blocked global humanitarian organizations from delivering aid to Afghans. Neil Turner, the Norwegian Refugee Council's country director, commenting on the first anniversary of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan and freezing of assets by the U.S., recently blasted the U.S. and the international community for pushing millions of Afghans into despair. Some prominent American and international economists also wrote a letter to Biden, urging him to release Afghanistan's frozen reserves, while expressing concern over economic catastrophes unfolding in the country.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Mohammed Asif, the director of Afghan Human Rights Foundation based in Scotland. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Asif. Now, 1 year since the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan, how were the motorcycle-borne Kalashnikov-wielding guerrilla fighters able to pummel the world's most powerful army with the most sophisticated weapons?
Because the invasion of Afghanistan was a failed war from the very start. You know, when Britain and America and NATO went to Afghanistan and they created this interim government, you know, in Bonn, probably if you remember the Bonn Agreement in Germany in 2001. So it was a failure from the start because, you know, the regime did not involve the complete different groups in Afghanistan, and Britain and America and NATO only empowered or brought to power the most vicious warlords and drug lords and mass killers and corrupt officials. And that was, from the start itself, was a failure because everybody was not involved, you know, in that interim government. But then America plus the United Kingdom and NATO and other countries who were involved in Afghanistan, they were not sincere, you know, helping the Afghans. They were only helping those who were at the highest or those who were at the top, you know, for their dirty war in Afghanistan. And the ordinary Afghans, as I say always, did not benefit from the invasion. In 2001, I myself wrote a letter to Tony Blair, as I call him, the war criminal, because he killed 1 million Iraqis and many hundreds of thousands in Afghanistan. I wrote a letter to Tony Blair and I demanded that the Taliban are a bunch of killers in 2001. But what are the replacement in Afghanistan? That who are we going to support? And I received a reply from Tony Blair in 2001. He said, and this is exactly his words, that we will not walk away from the Afghans, and this time we will stay with you until the end. And we saw what they have done in Afghanistan. You know, they did not help the ordinary people.
So, Mr. Asif, could we say that the aim of invading Afghanistan in 2001 was to make the mineral-rich country strategically located between Central and South Asia subservient to the West rather than eliminating the Taliban and Al-Qaeda?
The aim was obviously because Afghanistan is a very rich country in resources. You know, we have lithium, which is estimated over $2 trillion. We have a lot of minerals. Afghanistan have gas and oil. Afghanistan has the illicit trade of drugs, you know, which is itself is estimated, you know, nearly $7 or $8 billion a year. And that was one of the purposes, you know, to control these resources. And the other aim was, you know, behind the scene, they were preparing for another illegal war, you know, a war in Iraq, where, you know, they destroyed the Iraqi economy, they destroyed the life of 1 million individuals. So two interests were running, you know, concurrently with one another. One was to control the resources in Afghanistan, but it did not work. And the other thing was they were going to launch a war against an illegal war in Iraq. And that's why, you know, when they went to Iraq, Afghanistan was forgotten. The Taliban were getting stronger and stronger and stronger by day. And sadly, you know, end of the day, the innocent Afghan people lost. You know, many of them, hundreds of thousands were killed. People become internally displaced. People have no food. Right now, you know, almost the entire population have no food, you know. And on the top of it, the West is imposing sanctions. Sanction doesn't work. If sanction was working, it would have worked in Cuba. It would have worked on Iraq, in North Korea, in many other countries. But sanction only, you know, hit the poor people. It doesn't reach the rich and the powerful. And that's why, you know, they were defeated, as I said.
Mr. Asif, what about the frozen assets? How do you find the decision to freeze Afghan assets by the Biden administration at a time when the country is teetering at the brink of a major humanitarian catastrophe?
I mean, this is a daylight robbery. You know, it's like you're robbing someone during the day, daylight. You know, this is a robbery. That money doesn't belong to Taliban, or that doesn't money belong to the previous regime of Ashraf Ghani. That money is belong to the people of Afghanistan. It's the asset of Afghanistan. And, you know, the most powerful country, imagine in 21st century, the most powerful country is stealing money, you know, from the poor or the poorest country on earth, Afghanistan. America is rich country, but they're stealing the money from the Afghans. And now Biden was saying, or some time ago, Biden was saying this, the money will be divided into two sections. You know, one section will be a compensation for 9/11 victims, you know. But none of the Afghans were involved in 9/11 attack on America. I mean, my sympathies are with the people of America who were innocent and who were brutally killed in that terrorist attack in the United States. But Afghans were not involved, you know. Those who were involved in the conflict in 9/11, they were their close friends, Saudi Arabia. You know, most of the attackers were from Saudi Arabia. Why did the United States seize the asset of Saudi Arabia or the Middle Eastern countries in the United States, where the Saudis investing in trillions? You know, they have countless money invested in the United States.
There you have it, Mr. Asif, the director of Afghan Human Rights Foundation based in Scotland. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Inger Ashing, CEO of Save the Children, draws attention to the dire situation of children in Afghanistan 1 year since the Taliban takeover, urging the international community to provide aid to save children's lives. American journalist Danny Haypong says the Biden administration is committing a war crime by continuing to hold $7 billion in Afghan assets at a time when more than 90% of population suffers from hunger. Buzz Patterson, an author and consultant, recalls the day 1 year ago when the U.S. executed the worst military operation in Afghanistan, saying it will be taught in military classes as what not to do.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
India and Pakistan were born 75 years ago following a bloody partition engineered by the British. The two nuclear-armed neighbours with a common language, history and culture have since been at odds with deeply troubled relations. They have fought at least three major wars and regularly engage in border skirmishes, mainly in the contested territory of Kashmir, which is divided by a de facto border. Kashmir remains the main bone of contention between the two countries and a major hurdle in the restoration of bilateral relations.
India and Pakistan commemorated 75 years of their independence from British colonialism this week on August 15 and 14, respectively. Celebrations like every year were marked by grand displays. While both countries have undoubtedly taken giant strides in different fields over the years, they haven't quite fulfilled their full potential. In 1947, India's socioeconomic parameters matched those of China, including the level of poverty, literacy, health infrastructure, and etc. Since then, China has galloped ahead of its neighbor to become an economic powerhouse, while India is still struggling to enter the category of developed countries. A burgeoning population, institutional corruption, wrong economic policies, tensions with neighboring countries, political instability, and religious polarization have prevented the Hindu-majority country from marching ahead, as its founding fathers had envisioned. On the other hand, the story of Muslim-majority Pakistan is equally dismaying. The never-changing political instability in the country has greatly impacted its economic outlook. The country is currently in the throes of its worst political, economic, and constitutional crisis in the 75-year-old history. Soaring inflation, growing trade deficit, political crisis, politicized bureaucracy, and feudal system of governance continue to plague the nation 75 years after its creation, making it financially dependent on other countries and global bodies, such as International Monetary Fund.
India and Pakistan were born 75 years ago following a bloody partition engineered by the British. The two nuclear-armed neighbors with a common language, history and culture have since been at odds with deeply troubled relations. They have fought at least three major wars and regularly engage in border skirmishes, mainly in the contested territory of Kashmir, which is divided by a de facto border. Kashmir remains the main bone of contention between the two countries and a major hurdle in the restoration of bilateral relations.
Relations between arch rivals India and Pakistan over the past 75 years have been marked by long spells of hostility and antagonism and short bursts of calm and rapprochement. Their separation in August 1947 resulted in the killing of nearly 2 million people and the displacement of 15 million more. The bloodshed was engineered by Lord Mountbatten, the last British viceroy in India. Barely 2 months after the partition, first war broke out between the newly independent states over the Himalayan region of Kashmir. In January 1949, the 478-mile ceasefire line became a de facto border between them, dividing Kashmir into two parts. In 1965, the Second Indo-Pak War broke out, which was the culmination of a series of border skirmishes. 6 years later, in 1971, another major war between them ended with the birth of Bangladesh. In 1974, India became a nuclear power, while Pakistan's first test came much later in 1998. In 1999, the two militaries engaged each other in a 10-week war in Kargil. Over the past two decades, relations between the two neighbors have seen ebbs and flows, with incidents such as the 2008 Mumbai attacks, the 2019 Pulwama attack, and the revocation of Kashmir's semi-autonomy in August 2019, severely impeding efforts to bring them closer.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Saptain Ahmed Dar. He is a Pakistani academic and political scientist who is a senior lecturer and research fellow at the University of Lahore. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Ahmed Yar. Now, India and Pakistan are this week marking 75 years of their independence from the British. Now, do you think the two countries can claim to have achieved independence in the true sense of the word?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why? Because it really depends what independence means. If it is in the monetary, in the political, and in the social sense, there are a lot of questions that need to be answered, because Britain and the British Crown still consider Pakistan and India part of their Commonwealth of Nations. And this title basically comes from the British Crown and their royalty and their policy to continuously engage these nations that used to be part of the British colonial apparatus around the world, including some of the African countries and other states, including the states in Asia. Why is that? Because when British, through East India Company, came inside subcontinent, they were not only aiming to destroy the culture, to destroy the lingual background, to destroy the religion of that particular nation, but also they wanted to brainwash such nation into new systems in which the British wanted to rule them, and they wanted to brainwash the coming generation so that they would be continuously ruled by proxies even when they decolonized. So when we saw that in mid 18th century, when British came, they not only colonized, but they created that Raj system inside India, which aimed at exploiting the resources of the subcontinent people. And they had two options at that particular time. One is that through survey, they must understand that what sort of resources India can provide. Yes, we know it was about the limestone and the spices, and it also was meant to change the whole dynamics of subcontinent in such a way that the society becomes an economic province for the British Empire, and that's what they did. So even when we saw the War of Independence, we realized that both the Muslims and the Hindus joined their hands against the British so that they must have their, you know, status back, because they were, you know, being colonized and they were enslaved by these people. And it took them next, at least, you know, 100 years to do that again. But the scenario was different, in which we saw that both Muslims and Indians came, you know, entangled with each other because of two-nation theory, that Muslims and Hindus cannot live with each other.
Mr. Ahmadar, why has India, which was once seen as a competitor of China and some other global powers, lagged behind? And how did the world's second most populous country lose the script?
It's because of three main factors. First is the investment. The second is infrastructure. And then eventually manufacturing and production, which is key to the economic growth of any country. When it comes to these three areas, China surpassed the Indian economy during the Deng Xiaoping government. And this is why even in the Narasimha Rao government during the 1990s, India liberalized its economy. And Narasimha Rao eventually realized that if we have to compete and if we have to, you know, take the pace of the West, we must liberalize the economy just like the West has done. So they opened their gates and removed all of the tariffs in the 1990s, but they were already too late compared to China, which had already done the liberalization process 15 years ago before India during the Deng Xiaoping government. And in that particular government, we saw that Deng Xiaoping is sort of a capitalist, and he wants China to open its borders for the investment that is coming from outside. So when it comes to that particular scenario, I personally feel that, you know, it was that timeline of 15 years which made India lag behind China. And there are additional aspects to it. For example, after the Bretton Woods Agreement, when almost every single nation on the face of the planet agreed to peg their currency against the US dollar, I personally feel that American bankers and the big tech inside America decided China to be their perfect market. This is why a lot of business, huge and massive banks, have invested inside China so that they get cheap labor. The top richest families inside the United States, such as the Astors, the Rockefellers, the House of DuPont, and there are other as well. I feel Warburgers as well. They basically invested a lot inside China.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Ahmadar, a Pakistani academic and political scientist who is a senior lecturer and research fellow at the University of Lahore, for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Senior Iranian journalist and columnist Rana Ayyub says Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, in his Independence Day speech, spoke of women's empowerment, while the men accused of gang raping a Muslim woman years ago were released from jail the same day. Preeti Kaur Gill, a British Labour MP, talks about mixed emotions on India and Pakistan celebrating their independence days, noting that millions became refugees and at least 2 million people died during the partition. Data analyst and writer Nafiso Rahman Dorani says the independence days of India and Pakistan are the occasion to remember how the British turned the event into a horrific tragedy for millions of people.
And that was our episode about the first anniversary of the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan and 75 years of independence from colonial rule for India and Pakistan. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zindat dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned. Dear brothers and sisters, the Holy Quran admired two types of family. Of course, personally speaking, the Holy Quran admired many individuals like Mary or Maryam, Jesus or Prophet Masih, Zakaria and Idris. However, there are two families who have a special position in the eyes of Allah. The first example is the family of Zakaria in Ayah 90 of Surah Al-Anbiya. Over there, Allah admires Zakaria, his wife, and Prophet Yahya or John.
می فرماید این خانواده سه تا ویژگی داشتن.
In Ayah 90 of Surah Al-Anbiya, Allah refers to three features of Hazrat Zakaria's family. One important feature of this family was that they were after charitable works and always wanted to solve people's problems. Also, they called Allah with both hope and fear. And their third feature was their humbleness before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In other words, Allah has enumerated the features of a good family with exemplifying the family of Hazrat Zakaria.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of Arab English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. The gas. I filled my car and don't need to go to gas station for about a week. To be honest, I hate the smell of gas. Makes me feel bad. The oil and petrochemical products may remind many of Iran, though I particularly remember the city of Abadan in southwestern Iran, which its name is mingled with oil and oil refinery. Actually, today we are going to take a trip to Abadan in order to visit an amazing museum. Yes, Benzinkhane Museum, literally Gasoline House Museum. The first gas station in Iran was established at the center of the city of Abadan by British Petroleum Company in 1927. This site was initially used as a place for selling and distributing kerosene, though after a time, and by the import of cars to Iran, this site changed into a gas station. Earlier, fueling was done by manual pumps and then sold to customers. Benzinkhane Museum of Abadan, with an area of 1,856 square meters, is located in proximity of a new gas station in this city. The main building of the museum holds the documents, papers, and objects related to the gas station, including pumps, measurements, tins, and other devices which have been put on display. There are also two other minor buildings in the area, one used for exhibiting all the documents related to the distribution of petrochemical products in the country, and the other one used for the convenience of the visitors. I am now at Abadan Airport. I just got off the plane. The humid weather and the special scent of this city, which comes from petrochemical products. These two features tell me that I am in the city of Abadan. I love this city. I am now at Benzinkhane Museum of Abadan. At the main gate of the museum, there is a sign which reads, "The first gas station of Iran." Let's go inside the area of the museum. Such a pretty area. Oh, wow, palm trees. Eucalyptus trees and bougainvillea bushes have all made a very beautiful scenery. I am now at the western part of the area of the museum. Here, there is a collection of gas station equipment, each organized according to the year of its production and completion process. Oh, look. This is a glass manual pump. The sign next to it says, "This pump dates back to 1925. And here there are 12 systems made in Britain, US, Japan, as well as Germany, Australia, and India. Oh my God, this is amazing. Here, there is a gas station dating back to 1927, which is actually reconstructed. It's a brick-made building which has a sign in Farsi and old fonts that reads, "The Center for Selling Homemade Products." And on the other side, there is an advertisement which reads, "Just use the pure horse gas." And here, there is an old red Opel car, which is reconstructed, actually. This car is put in front of a replica of one of the oldest gas station systems in the world. There is also a replica of a gas station worker dressed in uniform, filling a car. It's made creatively. Oh, I completely feel I have traveled to 1927, though I wasn't born at that time. I am now in another hall of the museum. In this hall, there are domestic and industrial devices which work with petrochemical products, as well as banknotes and stamps related to the oil industry. There are also different types of lamps, kerosene lamps and kerosene stove. Remind me of my grandma's old house. And on the walls, there are old black and white photos. In this old photo, you can see men and women standing in a queue waiting for oil. Oh, look at here. There are different types of graduated measurements and 20-liter tins special for carrying fuel and petrochemical products. I was wondering how hard life was at those times. If you happen to visit Benzinkhane Museum of Abadan, look at the newspaper ads in this museum. I'm sure the old photos and writings which advertise oil make you feel excited.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much, and to you too.
Dear listeners, Brother Miqdad is Islamic researcher and teacher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. It's a pleasure to be with you, as always. Brother, in previous episode, we discussed about some of the pros of social media. You actually educated us about some of the very beautiful points that maybe are like our attention is not towards those things, but you really educated us on that, and we as parents could educate our teenagers about those pros and then ask them at the end of the day how much of successful use or like how much of pros you worked upon for the hours you were having access to social media. Well, today I would want to ask you about the cons of social media. How can we tell about that to our teenagers?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, so now that we've looked at the positives of social media and why, how we can use this as a positive tool, let's look at the negative aspect of social media. And this is mainly to try and see if it's possible for us to correct our usage and how we can improve the way we deal with this social media.
Yeah.
So first and foremost, the first negative point about social media is that it's time-consuming.
Yeah.
Time-consuming or time-wasting, I would say, in many cases. You find that very interestingly, and I'm sure any person who uses social media in as much as 2-3 hours a day would admit to using social media in a very inefficient way. So, for example, one of the things that we find in social media is doing repetitive work. So, as you go through your feed and as you go through the different pages on social media, you're very often doing repetitive work. So you'll do the same thing over and over and again, right? So you look at something and then many times we'll look at it again and we'll look at it again.
Look at things that are very... of FOMO, like fear of... You develop a condition of fear of missing out things.
Yes, missing out things, but... The point is more of doing the same repetitive work, basically.
Yeah.
Which is, once you, for example, let's say you watch a video, okay? Let's say it was a good video, it was a positive video, you learned something from it. Many times we'll either review the video many times.
Okay.
Or we'll view videos of the same topic and same subject multiple times.
All right.
Which is completely unnecessary. Or, for example, we'll... When it comes to personal messages or personal photos, you find that we'll be looking at the photos many times rather than doing it once, right? So you go to someone's Facebook page, for example, you look at their photos, what they've shared, and then you'll be doing once, and then a couple of hours later, you'll redo again, and then you'll check again. And sometimes even the photos that we post, right? You post your own photo, and then you look at your own photo again to check, that was a good photo, and you want to check again.
And then find out
why
people
are not liking it so much. Why don't I get so much attention for that photo? Can I change something? So it's kind of repetitive work all the time. Not being constructive, but being repetitive.
Okay.
Another thing about time consuming is that it's very distractive. So if you look at the way we work, is that we have our social media time throughout the day. It's not at a specific time. And so whenever you're doing something, however important it is, your social media is at the back of your mind. And so this is counted as a distraction. And this is why our focus is very less when we do some work. So when you're working, you always have half an eye on your Instagram page. You have half an eye on your Facebook, on your Snapchat, whatever it is. And this causes a distraction. So it's... And this distraction leads to actually double the amount of work, the amount of time it takes for you to do something. So let's say, for example, if you have an essay to write, let's say you're at school and you have an essay to write.
Okay.
Writing an essay might take you half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to sit down at 11, you would finish it at 11:30 or 11:45. But if you have your social media open in front of you as well as writing an essay, Because of this distraction and lack of focus on your work, this will take you double the time. So rather than being finishing at 11:30 or 11:45, you'll finish at 12:30, 12:45, 1. Right? So you see how inefficient we become because of social media.
All right. I'll continue that discussion with you after a short break. Hey, listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about how we can teach our teenagers about the cons of social media. Yes, brother.
And so this is why we tell youths that, and everyone, even adults, that whenever you want to work on something, you have a task to do, always put your phone away. Whether it's reading the Quran and praying, or whether it's writing an essay, or doing a project, or doing a meeting, put your phone away. It's just that it increases your efficiency in your work. And then have your social media timetable.
Efficiency, for example, as well as time. The exactly. time you spend in doing a particular work. If you're continuously checking your phone and checking these platforms, you actually lag behind in everything.
Exactly. So this is an important point. Another thing related to the same concept of time is that 2.5 hours of social media a day, if we look at it and you ask anyone, okay, you spent 2.5 hours, what did you really achieve? What did you really gain? And you find that it was a lot of time, it was wasted time. It wasn't time that I benefited from. So you can't say that, oh yes, I gained this and this. Or even if you did, it's something that doesn't require 2.5 hours of your time.
Yeah.
It can be done in 10 minutes. It can be done in 15 minutes. So we're very inefficient when it comes to our usage of social media. We need to increase how we use it to make sure that we're efficient. In the space of 30 minutes of social media, we can do a lot if we are careful, if we know the tricks of how to use social media. This time of 2.5 hours takes away from other important things that we could have done. We could have spent time with the family, with our children or our brothers and sisters, with our friends. We could have read a book. We could have watched an important documentary. We could have
done a lot of other work.
Exactly. We could have taken part in a course. We could have learned a skill. We could have built something. We could have done so much out there. But we wasted it using social media. And I guess everybody can review their own usage and say, okay, for myself, this might be a point that's valid and maybe I can reduce it. Amir al-Mu'mineen says in a very beautiful hadith that there is umrul mar'a la qimata lah. There is no price for man's lifespan, right? You would pay anything to live another 5 minutes if you know you're going to die right now.
You're going to die right now. So, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala also swears on the same time in the Holy Quran, says that without any doubt you are in loss. And then some with some exceptions, like if you don't have faith, if you are not doing good deeds and all.
That's correct. So we need to really pay attention to this point, that never should it be that social media is a source of time wasting for me. Okay. My life is too precious for it to be wasted on social media.
All right. So we need to guide out. First of all, we need to guide our teenagers about the importance of time. And then the time, the way that things, the way social media is actually consuming our time without the fact that we even realize it. So we need to educate our teenagers about that. Brother, I'll continue this discussion with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in the 80th surah of the Holy Quran, Surah Abbas, verse 24, says, فَلْيَنْظُرِ الْإِنسَانُ إِلَىٰ طَعَامِهِ. So let man observe his food.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm with Brother Miqdad, and we're talking about how we can teach our teenagers about the cons of social media. Yes, Brother.
Another negative about social media is the impact that social media has on self-esteem. So there's a lot of research out there. The listeners are more than welcome to go and on the different journals and the different articles out there that have shown a strong correlation between social media usage and our self-esteem.
Okay.
And so we find that individuals who use very serious users of social media have a decrease in their self-esteem. Why does this happen? Many points. The first one is due to being unproductive. So when we use social media, there is always a feeling of being unproductive after it because you really haven't done anything. There's nothing, as I say, your hands are not full after this. You haven't achieved anything. Your pockets are still empty when you are using social media. So after an hour or two of social media usage, you feel really empty. You feel that you haven't been productive. You haven't achieved anything. It's very...
And you only wasted time.
Exactly. So this lack of real results leads us to feel really down about ourselves.
Yeah.
And many times you might not realize it at that point, but later on when things impact your life, you realize that, yes, I don't feel satisfaction in my life. I don't feel like I've achieved anything. And many times it's caused by this usage of social media. It makes us being very unproductive. It's very contrary to, for example, stitching. So if you stitch a shirt, for example, right, or if you're knitting, or if you're working in a garden planting trees, for example, plants, if you're doing some DIY work in the garage and building something, all these things, they have a very positive feeling. They really help your self-esteem because you feel productive. You feel like, oh, I have achieved something. I managed to do something. You see result. You can feel result. You can see the plant growing. You feel happy about this. You feel that you made a shirt, for example. You feel that you...
You feel you're productive.
Exactly. With social media, after 2 hours, after 120 minutes, you feel nothing. You don't see anything. You don't see any results. You don't see any product out there. And so this leads to feel very negative about yourself, feeling very unsatisfied, feeling very unproductive, and this leads to feeling
lowered very self-esteem.
Exactly, low self-esteem, low confidence, and I don't see myself worthy of anything because I'm not good enough for anything.
All right, so I think there may be more cons we can talk about with our teenagers, and in this program we don't have enough time to discuss about that. And next session, inshallah, I'll be continuing this discussion with you. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to Islamic Upbringing. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for us, please feel free to contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. You can listen to this program again on our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanullah. God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.